just a raise your hand kind of a thing.
Oh, no.
Run over by a cyclist. Oh. Love it.
All right, good morning, everyone, and welcome back, Carla. I saw Carla over here. It's good to have you back. This is a work session of the Portland City Council. It is December 10th, 2018, and I want to thank everybody for being here today to talk about the city's results on our top priorities. Today's session fits into the changes that we're making to create a more stable, predictable, and transparent budget process. The goal of the improved process, of course, is to enable the city to achieve our long-term goals and meet the long-term challenges while sustainably maintaining core city services. At this work session, we aim to turn city data into information for decision making, with the goal of working smarter, not harder, in the coming year. To do that, we need to understand how well we're doing with our current resource allocations and with the policies and management practices that we currently have in place. Reviewing this information will help us focus on the results we're looking to achieve, especially as we consider our directions to develop next year's budget. We'll also highlight the results that several bureaus have achieved through business process improvements and using data to improve decision making. This practice of setting goals, evaluating our progress, and planning for the future is a practice that will enable the council to make real progress on issues like homelessness, resiliency, public safety, and others. This year, we'll discuss performance in tandem with the city's budget forecast. I anticipate this will sharpen our focus on achieving results for the community through improved management practices and not just applying new resources. With that, I'll hand this off to Interim Budget Director Kennard to begin the conversation. Good morning, and thanks for having us here.
Good morning. Thank you, Mayor, and good morning to members of Council. I also want to thank and say good morning to members of our community budget advisors who are here in the audience today. CAO Reinhart will be joining us at the table shortly, and Director Dassault from the Office of Equity and Human Rights, we hope, will be joining us as soon as he is able. Thank you for being here to discuss the very important topics of citywide performance and the financial forecast. This marks CBO's third year of highlighting citywide prior year performance for you in print and in a presentation format. This year, we're pleased to have made some notable improvements to the process, which the mayor already alluded to. First, we have organized the report in today's presentation to focus on priority issue areas, irrespective of bureau boundaries, in contrast to previous reports and discussions which tend to take a bureau-by-bureau approach. While this may seem like a small and common sense change, it implies a much bigger change. For the city to govern and problem solve beyond bureau silos is a change we all know to be significant. This type of change necessitates a cultural shift that requires all of us, bureau staff, elected leadership, and community members, to change the way we address and invest in key issue areas. Many of the changes to the budget process that we are implementing this year aim to further facilitate this shift, and empower council and bureaus to work together towards our common goals. Another improvement we have made to the structure of today's presentation is to make the data and information more actionable for council. We know that in today's world, we are all inundated with data. What CBO is attempting to do with this report and this presentation is to turn performance data into useful, objective information to help inform your decision-making. We have worked with bureaus to highlight the data that we believe will be most useful to you as decision-makers going forward. We will be teeing up discussion around key CBO findings and recommendations related to performance data to help inform investment decisions, and we have changed the timing of this presentation to be able to contextualize the performance discussion within the city's financial forecast. you want to go to the slideshow. Are we able to have the slideshow up there for the members of the public? To that end, today's agenda will begin with Josh's general fund forecast. We will then spend the bulk of the time today reviewing and discussing fiscal year 2017-18 performance data findings and recommendations. One thing to note is in an effort to prioritize your time, we have reduced the number of key issue areas we'll discuss to four priority areas. We've selected these areas as council priorities based on recent investments and conversations with council, but also because we found valuable and informative data we wanted to share with you. So, to fully immerse ourselves in the performance lingo, the general goals that I've laid out thus far are really the bigger, longer-term outcomes that we hope to move towards through this presentation. In the spirit of good performance management, we've also identified a few key outputs or more specific and shorter-term goals that we'd like to achieve with today's session. These include understand and discuss the data behind key council and city priorities and issues, recognize and learn from the bright spots in bureau and city performance, identify and discuss potential solutions to address complex challenges with a work smarter, not harder approach, as the mayor alluded to. Consider goals and priorities in the context of the financial outlook. We hope that today's session will be and will include a fruitful discussion and encourage you all to interject at any time with your thoughts or your questions. With that, I'll turn it over to our city economist, Josh Harwood, to provide our economic outlook.
All right. Thanks, Jessica, Mayor, Commissioners. Josh Harwood, city economist. We are going to go through this as fast as you want, I guess. But initially, we're going to rip the Band-Aid off fast and get to the numbers. The first slide, we'll talk to you about kind of where we're at with the general fund forecast. We expect that the December forecast, and the numbers are still wiggling a little bit because of overhead model things and things that are sort of we're working through. But basically, we would expect the general fund forecast for December to show a very small amount of ongoing resources available for the 1920 budget, about $1 to $3 million, and an additional $12 to $14 million in one time available. The way to think about where we are is the 1% constraint got us about $5.5 million. The commitments the council has made both in budget notes and in the fall bump offset most of that. And so essentially the forecast is largely unchanged from April. And we'll get into some more details as we go. But essentially, property taxes came in actually a little bit lower this year. We're working with the county to understand that a little bit better. We're waiting on some reports from them. But essentially, property taxes came in lower. We're showing some weakness in a couple other revenue sources. And so as we work through this, we can talk a little bit more about the specifics. But there's pretty solid uncertainty within the forecast right now. As we flip to the next slide, in fact, in my tenure here at the city in about 8.5 years, this is the most uncertainty that I've been experiencing at this time of year. and you can see on the graph on the right is our business license tax collections July to November. There's a couple of things I want to highlight about this graph in particular. The trend line, if you take out last year, holds. So the trend line is still increasing. They're still going up. The change from last year, though, is notable. And so, especially given that we've got a lot of moving parts within that. So this forecast was a great challenge. We've worked, our friends at the county have the same revenue stream, and so we've been working closely with them to try to understand a little bit more about how the numbers are moving back and forth. But things like the federal tax law change did incentivize companies to essentially, what amounts to prepay their taxes to us. We also had some repatriation, so profits that were brought back from overseas that required some payments from large companies. That was a one-time amount that we're working on trying to contextualize a little bit better. But overall, the trend line's still pretty good. We've also got a tax rate increase that is embedded this year, this tax year. How that plays out, we'll have to see, because the companies really don't have to pay that higher tax rate until April, and in some cases, if they get an extension, until October. So, so we're flying a little bit with a little bit cloudier glasses than we normally do. As we move forward, and I would expect that the construction activity, in particular, within that revenue stream, to slow. So we've had some massive property transactions over the last few years that have yielded some capital gains to corporations that were required to essentially pay what amounted to one-time monies. And that's been a significant driver. So we wouldn't expect that to continue forever. And there are signs that it may not continue for very much longer. So there's a little bit of uncertainty there. I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about sort of contextualizing where we are economically in Portland and what we've been experiencing through this expansion. So as we flip to the next slide, we can talk sort of about the Portland experience from 2010 to 2017. This is census data information. And so all of these categories are related. they all paint the same picture largely. But we've had massive growth in an educated workforce and in income, and in median household income growth. That has borne itself out in higher rental costs, higher home values. We are the fastest growing population of people who living with non-relatives. So these are people that need roommates now because housing costs have accelerated beyond incomes. And we have the seventh largest increase in commuting time. It's a byproduct of a good economy. One byproduct of a good economy is really bad traffic. And we're certainly seeing that. I'm sure you hear it when you're out in the community. Yeah, I mean, that's the reality. People have more money to do more things. People have more jobs. It's intuitive, I think, that would be a byproduct of what we've been experiencing. The other thing...
We also have Uber and Lyft, so there's that.
There is that as well. And so the other thing that I would point out is that we've had... Population growth has one reason for this happening is population growth has been about 40% faster than household formation growth or housing unit growth. So that's driving a lot of what you're seeing. It feels like we've built a lot, and we have. There's been a lot of building that's still going on. It's not been enough to keep up with population growth. And so when that happens, you see a lot of these byproducts result. As we look sort of broadly at the economic conditions, currently they're pretty good. The federal stimulus is an interesting experiment. The tax cuts came at a time when the economy was doing pretty well anyway. It's harder to decouple sort of the stimulus effect within the economy, but the economy is doing pretty well. The graph at the bottom is just illustrative of how different it is right now. There are more job openings than unemployed people in this country, and it's been that way for about 6 months. In fact, the latest data in October shows that there are about 1 million more job openings than unemployed people. So while there is a skills mismatch, perhaps, in some of these cases, the reality is that companies are having trouble finding people. We would expect over the next year or so to see wages be driven higher. We've already seen that in some cases, especially at the lower end. There's companies that are more willing to pull people in and train them on site rather than having them have the experience coming in. So there are byproducts that have been pretty good. The consensus is that there's not going to be a recession in the next 12 to 18 months. It gets a little murkier after that for a variety of reasons. As we flip to the next page, we can talk a little bit about those reasons, the headwinds, as we call them. If we had done this presentation about 6 months ago, I think we'd be more concerned about rising interest rates and inflation. That hasn't materialized to the extent that I think was anticipated relatively recently. In fact, mortgage rates are about at a 6 or 7 month low. So that's easing the concern a little bit. The equity markets are, while not directly related to our revenue sources, do provide sort of an example of some uncertainty within the economy, right? So we're talking about the stock market. It's been bouncing around pretty violently over the last month or so. And that is indicative of sort of the uncertainty around sort of the general economic conditions. And frankly, policies coming out of Washington that can change relatively rapidly around things like tariffs and trade wars and those kinds of things. There is sort of growing concern about 2020. We tend to have a recency bias about the economy. It's been going good. There's no reason it won't go good for a little bit longer. The reality is that the business cycle does still exist. The demographics overall, so the aging baby boomers sort of create a situation where baseline growth is a little bit lower than it might otherwise be as they age out of their prime earning years. And so that, along with sort of the construction cycle, is the other piece that we're looking at very closely, especially locally, but nationally as well. And so the table at the bottom of that slide is sort of it was a bit alarming to me. Let's put it that way. If we work from left to right, the left is sort of the type of unit, right? The vacancy rates. You'll notice the vacancy rates are the highest amongst the smallest units. The effective annual rent change. So this is rent increases minus concessions. So in large parts of the city, developers and building owners are having to issue large amounts of concessions to get people to move in the door, whether that's a free month rent or other incentives that provide them. So it's net of that. But then we look at the last column and units under construction, and we're building a lot of units in the softest parts of the market. And so that going forward, I would expect to create larger decreases in rents, which is not a bad thing. But for developers, it makes their investments more tenuous. And so that, in combination with other market conditions, the aforementioned rising interest rates, building loan construction tightening, so construction loans tightening, create a situation, and I think you've probably all been briefed, we're already seeing some of the front end of that at BDS, our Development Services Bureau. And so there's that along with declining amounts of even public sector building probably in the next couple of years. We're doing a lot of that right now. There's not necessarily a lot of that in the pipeline, with maybe the exception of OHSU. I'm not sure we can fit a whole lot many more hotels in the downtown area and finance them. So especially given there's, I think, 8 or 9 still in the pipeline to come online. So I think 2020 looks a little bit murkier. We wouldn't expect anything like what happened in 2008, but we are a little bit less sure about sort of where we're going there.
So, Josh, I always try to find the good news in your economic reports, and I see an obvious one here, which is if there is a mismatch here in terms of what is available in the market and what is currently under construction, and that actually fits with our affordable housing goals, that means it's going to be a buyer's market relative to what it's been in recent years if you happen to have a source of funding for said housing, which we happen to have. So I think there are actually going to be some good opportunities going forward just by virtue of the fact that there does appear to be a mismatch between supply and demand on the rental side.
I think the
units that, frankly, we need.
I think that's exactly right from that perspective. I think the overall concern is more about how much longer people will continue to build the units if the market changes dramatically.
Well, and you should be able to infer that based on permit applications.
Right. Right. Yes. And we've seen a pretty massive decline in permit applications. So this is a longer-term outlook. Sort of, I wanted to put down some forecast scenarios. It's been a long time since we talked about what a recession actually looks like, or what a downturn actually looks like budgetarily. And so while we are in a situation in Portland where, right now, let me back up one second. The way to think about this is Portland looks budgetarily and economically, frankly, very different from most of the country. We are growing faster than most of the country, as you've seen. We are experiencing those growing pains associated with that. We also look different than we have historically against our own self, against Portland. Portland historically is a different city than it is today. And so that creates that need for greater uncertainty, or that feeling of greater uncertainty. What we did here is I just put down a couple of forecast scenarios. The magnitude of these are garden variety sort of slowdowns given where we are. The magnitude of this is roughly cuts of $30 to $40 million. So when we're talking about a recessionary environment, we're not talking generally about sort of thinning the soup, right? Just sort of picking at edges and stuff. We're talking about stopping doing programs. So if we get to a point where we're doing that, council needs to consider the fact that we're going to need to stop doing some things that we're doing. It's not going to be sort of picking at edges. So I think I just want to put that in some context for you, especially given our exposure in business license taxes and lodging taxes. Those make up a larger proportion of the general fund than they ever have before. And so even a modest downturn can result in some pretty dramatic dollar figures. So as we move to sort of next steps, we will publish an official forecast document by the end of next week. And so we will send that to you, and you should be looking for it. The important dates, we'll get actual COLA data in mid-January. So we're currently forecasting 4%. That would be the highest since 1991. That's putting additional budgetary pressure. As we say, good for employees, bad for the city budget. And so we are sitting there at pretty high levels. We'll issue a forecast update in February and the final forecast near the end of April. We thought we'd lean in a little bit to Commissioner Fisher's Saltzman rule. And just to kind of get a sense of sort of what that means, over the last 7 years, that median increase has been about, in available resources, has been about $4 million. So to the extent that this forecast is where it is, I wouldn't expect a large change, although with the greater uncertainty comes both upside and downside. So that's the general concept of where we are right now. I'm happy to answer some questions. Otherwise, we can kick it back for the past discussion.
All right. So this isn't a question. It's more of a maybe an aspiration. You're giving us pretty clear direction that the economy is starting to show signs of slowing. And you've painted a couple of scenarios in terms of what that could look like in terms of pressure on the general fund. And we budget year to year, but I think the admonition here is we should really be thinking longer term, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we budget year to year, but the balancing mechanism, the five-year balancing mechanism, does mean that we're not as exposed as we might be otherwise. So you'll notice two things. One, the county has a 3% constraint that they're issuing. Their revenue structure and cost structure is a little different, so it's a little bit apples to oranges, but it's sort of a different scenario. Our balancing, you'll notice that if you look back over the last few years, we've had, say, 20 to 30 million in one time each of the last 3 or 4 years. If we had built that into ongoing, our exposure would be that much more. Mm-hmm. So we have been disciplined because of the balancing mechanism, the five-year balancing, so we're not quite as exposed, but it is still significant.
Thank you.
I have a question. It's kind of a comment and a question. Mayor Adams helped us get through the recession thanks partly to the Obama stimulus package. We had good construction jobs, and we also had then Portland Development Commission doing construction in South Waterfront when nobody else was doing construction. And we know that construction jobs tend to be the ones that are family wage jobs that kept people employed. Are there things that we could do now to be thinking about how to be prepared should there be a national recession and therefore some kind of an infrastructure bill appropriations? Are there things that we should be prioritizing that will help prepare us for the next downturn?
I think we've done some of those things with the capital set aside monies that we've made available. One of the preparations with the Build Portland activity, we've spent a lot of money, or we're spending a lot of money relative to history, not relative to where we need to be maybe, but on infrastructure right now. That will obviously help weather any recession. What I think would be a decent focus, and bureaus could talk about this a little bit more than I can specifically, is the ability to push projects out the door. So whatever that pipeline is, shortening that, making a process as fast as we possibly can, will allow us to be a little bit more nimble should a recession happen and sort of initiate those dollars quicker.
Of course, I mean, it's a double-edged sword, right? Because we're often incurring O&M. On new capital investment, So, I mean, we could have a plan to turbocharge the construction of new parks, for example, and invest resources like systems development charge dollars and other things. But it has the short-term effect of throwing your five-year forecast out of whack and having to come up. So how do you balance, on the one hand, the desire to maintain a certain level of capital spending with the reality of O&M costs that we have to anticipate that compete with all the other priorities?
No, I think that's absolutely right, Commissioner Fish. I would just say that not all infrastructure spending looks the same or creates the same amount of O&M. I mean, there's if we rebuild a bridge in PBOT, it doesn't have the same impact as building a new park. And so there's strategies within that broad framework to mitigate some of that concern.
By the way, what's our current population?
About 650,000.
And when do you forecast we might hit 700,000?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't have it in front of me. We can expect probably between 1 and 1.5% growth, at least as the economy is good. When the economy falters, migration slows. So that would get us there in, doing the math off the top of my head, let's call it 7 years.
So if there's no further questions, we're going to move on to the performance aspect of today's presentation. This presentation draws heavily on the prior year performance report, as we mentioned earlier, reviewing the results of city programs and services in the context of the previous year's budget. This report provides analysis on budget and performance data, issues recommendations, and poses key questions back to you all. So we're doing a little bit, again, of the looking back and looking forward. We're looking back at last year's data, but really with an eye towards the issue areas that we know Council wants to address during this next budget cycle and beyond. We've organized the report to that end around 7 key issue areas, which have recent years been consistent areas of focus and investment priorities. For this presentation, we further refined the topics to include just 4 priority areas. Today, we're going to talk about public safety and police accountability, meeting Portland's housing need, increasing city sustainability, and using data and technology to improve government services. For the folks here and watching at home that are eager to know more about the city's performance, I'd encourage you to read the full report and to visit the City Budget Office performance webpage, where, as the slide shows, you can peruse dashboards that highlight performance for every bureau in the city. For today's presentation, from a time management standpoint, I want the group to know that there are many more findings related to the first 2 topics, so we expect those sections to take a lot more time as we walk through. I also want to clarify that when we talk about data, we're not just referring to scientifically significant quantitative data. The Office of Equity and Human Rights recently brought in a facilitator to train city leadership on results-based accountability, and she pointed out that relying on exclusively this type of data perpetuates systems of inequity. So I want everybody to be thinking about, when we talk about data, we're not just talking about the traditional use of quantitative data, but there are other areas where we might be able to solicit more qualitative and other types of data as well. So Shannon Kearney is here, our performance management lead, and she will begin each section with an overview of the topic area, and we'll dive into the findings and close with recommendations. But again, please feel free to jump in with your thoughts and discussion at any point.
Great. Thank you, Jessica. So once again, I'm Shannon Kearney from the City Budget Office. And I just want to say, before we jump into our first section on meeting Portland's housing need, this work represents a huge body of work for both our CBO analysts and also our partners in the bureaus, thinking about this information, thinking about what it means, and coming up with some next steps to really make the most of our investments. So wanted to provide kudos to those that have worked on this report and the presentation. Thank you. So we start off with housing, and reducing the unmet housing need was the original goal of A Home for Everyone. And I think this section is particularly important given the interest in converting what are currently one-time resources for the Joint Office into ongoing funding. And really what we'll cover in this section is a little bit on what we've done since the state of housing emergency was declared. As you know, it's been 3 years. And as you probably also know, we're at really record service provision on our homeless prevention and our affordable housing development. However, even at these record levels, these services are falling significantly short of demand. And we know this not just anecdotally, but we know this because it's evidenced by wait lists for housing placements, rental assistance, and other programs like home repair and legal aid. While we're doing more than ever before, we actually need better outcomes information to know if we're meeting our goals for the community. Tell myself next slide. So the first slide, we're going to just take a quick look at look back at the 3 years since the original state of housing emergency was declared, and really look at some of the actions that have come around since then. And these highlight some of the major actions. There's been others as well, but of course, October 7th, 2018 marked 3 years since we declared that state of housing emergency. And over that time, we've really dramatically expanded our funding and programming along the housing continuum. With both a significant investment of one-time funding for both short-term and ongoing services. And one point here as we look at how the actions have changed is that the state of housing emergency has really evolved from being more narrowly focused on immediate responses to homelessness to encompass a much broader swath of the entire housing spectrum. And we've added new policies, not only funding, but policies, programs, and, of course, regulatory responsibilities to the state's portfolio. You know, beyond just the original state of housing emergency, just highlighting a few of the actions, of course, we increased our provision of tax increment financing that goes towards affordable housing development. That's really the second note. Year two, most significantly there, of course, we created, along with the county, the Joint Office of Homeless Services with the goal of reducing unmet housing need by June 2017. And then year three, lots of things in year three. So we implemented a new inclusionary housing program. We've created the rental service office. And of course, voters have passed several affordable housing bonds, both at the city and the regional level.
I just asked Shannon Callahan how much does the city dedicate to the joint office, and the answer is $32 million a year this fiscal year. Okay. How much the federal government dedicates to homeless services? $2 million a year. So when people are saying, you know, we should do it all, we can't do it all with that level of imbalance.
Yep, thank you for that, Commissioner. So looking at what all this significant investment means, especially at the local level, we are serving more people than ever before, and over this past year. So that's what we found with our our output performance information in FY 2017-18. You can see just on the graphs, the left side is the joint office placement and homeless prevention, so several programs within that joint office funding, whereas the right side is our affordable housing development. And in both cases, it's pretty clear how much we're growing in terms of what we're doing to serve people in the community. And we actually are significantly exceeding even our own service targets. So that's all really good news. And it reflects, you know, basically our commitment to the community and addressing this problem. So on the next slide, I think it's important to note that, as we said in the summary, you know, even though we're providing more services than ever before, it's actually pretty difficult for us to assess the impact on our overall unmet housing need. So in this next slide, what you see on the right is our homeless point-in-time count, which is really our traditional outcome measure for homeless service provision. And one thing to note is on the top, you see how our level of service is going up. So that's a number from the previous slide. So we're serving more people. You know, around 35,000 in this past year. But what we don't know as much about is how that's impacting our actual number of homeless. Our most recent data is from the January 2017 point-in-time count, which we conduct every other year. And that's a major challenge, is having that huge lag in data. Obviously, we've ramped up our service provision significantly since then, and so having that as a baseline comparison makes it difficult for us to know what our impacts are. So we do know, and I think it's been noted in other presentations, but we do know that our unsheltered homeless population went down with that January 2017 count. So I think it would be important to know more about, you know, we obviously want to see that trend continue.
Can I ask a couple of questions on that? Because I've been hearing this since we got here, that we're putting more into shelter, more into services, more into the transition to housing, more into housing, but we really don't know what the impact is. So could you work with us and the Joint Office on what data would actually be required to be able to answer that question? I've toured other communities around the country, and they have homeless, you know, data information systems where various nonprofits and government agencies share data, and so they can actually track individuals through the system, and they know what the outcomes are for that individual and what interventions that individual needs. We have big pieces of that system in place, but we don't have a really truly unified system that collects this data. And I think, frankly, we need to stop talking about the lack of information and start doing something about it. So I would encourage, and I'll talk to the chair about this, I would encourage you and the county and the Joint Office to engage in a thoughtful process about what data we need collected. And then as we contract for services with nonprofit providers, we need to get them onto the same platform. Because collectively we're putting, $62, $63 million now between the city and the county and the Joint Office, and we need to know what outcomes we're actually getting. I mean, we know some of them. We know how many people received prevention services that didn't become homeless. We know how many people we transferred from the streets or shelter into housing, and those are good data points. But there are other data points we could also have that we just don't have, and we need them.
Absolutely. Thank you for saying that. And, you know, that's really why we wanted to highlight the lack of data in this conversation today, is to create a little bit more urgency around actually a lot of the work that is underway in the Bureau and the Joint Office. And we'll touch on that a little bit later. But thank you for that.
Okay. So can I just want to put a fine point on this. So do I have your commitment then that we are going to work with the Joint Office and we're going to identify what specific data sets we need that we don't currently have access to? Are we going to do that?
Absolutely.
Yes, ma'am.
Fabulous. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Fantastic. So, and just to piggyback on that a little bit while we're still on this topic of homeless services outcomes. So one piece of that puzzle, and I think this speaks to, you know, what are the data sets that we need, one proposed solution that we have here is to really move forward with a every other year, so alternating our HUD point-in-time count with an out-year sampling of the homeless population to provide more timely data. And this is something that has been discussed for a while. Again, I think, you know, we know that we need to move forward with understanding, having more data on a yearly basis. And it would also help us understand how homelessness looks different as the seasons change.
Yeah, I was really struck by the Oregonian article a few weeks ago that the number of unsheltered students has gone down in Portland public schools. So that's one other data point. I'm wondering if there are other things like the length of the waiting lists for affordable housing, the number of contacts made by the one point of contact. It seems like there's a lot beyond the point in time. There's other statistics that we could get from service providers, of course, disaggregated or aggregated so we don't get individuals. But, you know, even like who signed up for the Oregon Health Plan without an address or with an address that we know that is a post office box or Sisters of the Road, those kinds of things.
Absolutely. So some of that data is already available. It's just a matter of putting it together and thinking about
it. Yeah, and it's only their data, but even like the waiting list for the that Joint Office has. Let's track that year after year.
Right. Thank you. Great. So looking ahead, similar to the point in time count, so one thing we talk about with our affordable housing development is closing the gap. So closing the gap of the affordable housing need that we see in the community. And the challenging thing about this outcome measure is that it is a projection, it is an estimate, and it's based on pretty old data. So we have there's a graph that you'll see on the right, and that is really, it's a pretty, I would say, capital E estimate, right? And one thing that we know is that while we can build all the affordable housing units that we have resources for, we do want to know if we're closing that gap. So we wanted to point out that, you know, the new rental registration system is going to be a real opportunity to have more data on the rental market in the Portland community, and we can use that data to model what the affordable housing gap is and know a lot more precisely about how those units are landing. All right, so.
I have a quick question. Sorry, just want to go back to the unmet housing need. Sorry to put you on the spot, but what
it's fine.
Do you know the HUD homeless definition? So there's unsheltered.
So that homelessness be, well, I know the goal that it be brief, but the definition of homelessness?
Well, because there seems to be three different levels. There's unsheltered, there's people who meet the HUD homeless definition, and then I think there's a third population which isn't reflected in this, which is people who are technically homeless but staying with friends or family.
If you could identify yourself for the record, please.
Jane Marie Ford, City Budget Office. So I think you're referring to the doubled up population, which past counts have tried to capture. And that is another way that sampling could be used, or some of these other data sets like school lists, other wait lists can kind of capture the folks who wouldn't be considered technically homeless by the HUD definition, but are still housing vulnerable or have other challenges that might be met through different interventions.
Okay, so people who are doubled up do not meet the HUD definition of homeless.
Correct.
Okay, great.
But I'm certain there would be overlap in population since the point in time count is a snapshot.
Yeah.
So you would probably see folks who are moving through different, they're going to be in different places at different points.
Yeah. I mean, the past number that I've heard is 16,000, but that number has been floating around out there for a couple years. So obviously there is quite a data lag. Oh, hi, Tom. Where'd you come from? And why is your chair so low?
Good morning. Strategic, I don't, on someone's part.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Yep. Thank you. So, with that, those are just some of the high-level findings that we saw in looking at a wide variety of data on this topic. I'll pass it back to Jessica to talk about next steps in this area.
Well, so again, and I think Shannon covered these really well, and actually, with the mayor and Commissioner Fritz's input, you guys already touched on some of our recommendations. But you know, given that the funding level and the supply of housing and homeless services is far greater than it's ever been, and we're still not meeting demand for services, clearly some action needs to be taken. Part of the challenge is what, you know, Commissioner Fritz alluded to. We're largely taking this on from a financial standpoint locally on our own. But part of the challenge is that what we refer to as the housing need or the housing crisis includes a very large spectrum of different needs that require distinct approaches and services. So, Commissioner Udaly, to your point. And arguably, each of those areas have unmet needs. So this fact makes it very difficult to quantify the problem, which we're trying to solve, which in turn makes it very challenging to assess the relative impact and effectiveness of our investments. So, you know, to the mayor's point, it's difficult to know if you're on the right train, even if it seems like you're heading in the right direction, if you don't know the final destination of that train. So CBO recommends that we start addressing these challenges by identifying the specific measurable outcome level goals for our homeless services and for our housing, affordable housing portfolio. It's particularly important that we develop these long-term goals and funding plan considering the context of our economic cycle, given all that Josh just said and given the county's release of the 3% reduction targets. Given that demand will likely always outpace resources absent significant changes at the federal level, we also need to identify our highest priority investments and interventions and be able to track the effectiveness of investments. We can't know if we're being successful unless we define what success looks like. So we need to define what success looks like in both short-term and long-term senses. So I wanted to state, so we're on the recommendation slide now. And there's a matrix that we're providing with each of our recommended actions. I think it's really important that we separate the useful long-term tools that are provided by the state of housing emergency, such as the zoning code changes, from the actual declaration of emergency. So we've now been in a state of housing emergency for 3 years, and that has facilitated a lot of really important changes that have helped us address this need. But I think, and I know that the Housing Bureau is looking at this, the ways to sort of preserve some of the tools that provides for us while sort of sunsetting the state of emergency that we've started. In addition, it's really important that we acknowledge that this is not that houselessness is not a problem that adheres to jurisdictional boundaries, right? It's a regional issue, if not larger. So it's really important that we collaborate with our regional public and private partners to secure commitments for this long-term strategy. So once we know our final destination, we need to increase the availability of information to be able to assess whether we're getting what we want. To be able to achieve our goals efficiently and effectively.
Question.
So, yes, go ahead.
I wasn't on council when the state of emergency was declared and passed, so I don't know offhand if there were specific measures that would justify a sunset. So would it be vacancy rates rising above a certain point? Would it be percentage of cost burdened renters or homeless individuals? I mean, I know our vacancy rate is up, but mm-hmm. there is a gross mismatch between mm-hmm. what's available and what's needed. And so the housing emergency isn't over, and I'm not convinced that that vacancy rate change would justify declaring an end to it. Mm-hmm. So
that's a good question. So the original goal of A Home for Everyone was to reduce the unmet housing need by half, and the focus was on
reduce the what?
Unmet housing need.
Okay.
And with that original focus of basically unsheltered homelessness. So back to the point of how things have evolved, that now we're looking, you know, much more broadly, and the subsequent ordinances that were passed reflect that broader look. It may make sense to establish, you know, some sort of indicator. At the same time, I think given the budget forecast, it probably makes more sense to establish a service level. So while we have that long-term goal in mind, you know, in terms of, you know, actually sunsetting the ordinance, what we recommend in looking at this is that we take the useful pieces of the ordinance, ensure that those are tools in our toolbox for the next 5 years or longer, and then look at what service levels we can provide and how that's tracking to our long-term goals. So that's what I would say, rather than establishing specific indicators like vacancy rates.
Yeah, I guess I've always associated the state of emergency with renters as much as I have with people experiencing homelessness, because that state of emergency came out of demands advanced by tenant advocates, and one of the first actions was to increase the notice time or at least one of the first tangible actions to the public was to increase notice time for rent increases, significant rent increases, and no cause evictions. So I'm surprised to hear that you consider the focus to be on the unsheltered population.
Just the original focus.
Okay.
So I was just referencing the original goal, which you know was really an outcome goal, and that original ordinance had a much more narrow focus, whereas you're right, subsequent updates have had a much larger focus on the rental community.
And I appreciate you saying look at what it does and what it allows us to do, and then do we have long-term five-year strategies to do that? One of the examples was it provides some exemptions in the zoning code, which you alluded to. We haven't yet changed the zoning code to make those permanent, so that would be one indicator that is very necessary to locating short-term housing.
Absolutely.
So we'd need to fix that, just as an example.
Yeah, I just want to be clear. The Housing Bureau is actually going through an exercise right now looking at what the emergency ordinance allowed the city to do in order to be responsive to the homeless crisis, to the housing crisis, and trying to figure out either what code changes need to take place or whatever policy changes need to come to the council for review. The way you described it, I think Shannon is correct. You know, the council needed to act to be able to respond to the crisis, but a lot of the actions that the council has taken are things we should be able to do anyway on an ongoing basis. So Shannon Callahan and her team are working through some proposals for the with the council.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thanks.
Can I just raise a question? Because I'm all for having more data and better measurements, but you know, I go back to something on page 15 of your PowerPoint where you list actions to address state of housing emergency, and the singular event that you identify as essentially a win is functionally ending veterans' homelessness, which only happened because a president of the United States declared that to be a singular goal of his housing strategy. And we were eligible for vouchers, VASH vouchers, and we worked to streamline the relationship between the VA and our nonprofit partners and the city, and a lot of work went into that. So it begs a question. We did make huge progress on veterans' homelessness, but it's because the federal government identified it as a priority, not because Little Portland decided that we were going to end veterans' homelessness. And in fact, I can't think of an area of homelessness that is more national in scope than veterans' homelessness, because we have nothing to do with declaring war, sending people off, you know, honoring commitments when they come back. And so it begs another question in my mind, which is, are we looking for outcomes and data measurements that are aligned to the resources we have available, or are we setting the goal of assuming we're on our own and we're trying to solve the problem? Because unless we account for partnership and the supply side, we can do all kinds of measurements, but we got to be honest to people about the fundamental limitations of our reach.
Absolutely.
Does that make clear? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's 100% right. I would say with that particular victory, it was significantly, as you said, Commissioner, because of the funding that was made available by the federal level. I will also say that the local level, we really, one of the benefits of that support from the feds was that we were able to coalesce around a common goal, and there was a lot of work and collaboration that happened to get us to that goal.
I convened the first meeting with the VA, and it led to a change in leadership in terms of who was overseeing the program, and the VA was, housing was not their core mission, and so there was a lot of change that had to happen, and then some waivers and the like. But that's an example where we had a robust federal partner, and we were able to make a big dent. There's a lot of talk about Utah and the Utah experience. Mm-hmm. Of course, what Utah did is they also focused on one part of the homeless crisis, declared victory, but it came at the expense of not investing in other significant parts, and they made some very tough calls about who they were or were not going to prioritize. Mm-hmm. So, again, in terms of what the public hears from us, are we coming up with a set of matrices that say, you know, that hopefully illustrate that we're spending our money wisely, or are we trying to set up a set of data points that says here's what it would take to solve the problem, which is also going to underscore the fact that we can't solve the problem with our current resources. We don't have adequate resources. Yeah. And without a more robust partner in Washington, we functionally cannot solve the problem.
I think that those options are exactly right. I think we need to start with having that conversation and figuring out what we would want to achieve, what is a reasonable goal, had we all of the partnership that we would desire from the federal government and other partners, and then look really realistically at what we can achieve without that partnership, because we can't bank on additional funding coming in from the federal government. I will say that there are additional areas regionally where we can enhance our collaboration and our partnership, both with the private sector and with public sector partners. I know that Commissioner, you are working really hard around the area of permanent supportive housing, and that's an issue area where we're looking to really collaborate with some of our potentially with our private sector partners to help accommodate the full spectrum of services that are needed there.
Just want to make a point. Tom Reinhart, Chief Administrative Officer. Thanks for having me. I appreciate the City Budget Office inviting me today. First off, there's been a lot of conversation among bureau directors in the 3 years since the housing emergency was declared, and we have recently begun asking the Housing Bureau to come in and update directors to to continue to instigate conversation among the leadership of the city in terms of what options should be presented to council going forward. So building on Commissioner Fritz's comment about the federal government's current commitments and what Commissioner Fish just laid out in terms of getting clear about what our capacity is and what problems we are trying to solve, I want to thank Director Callahan for being open to that discussion, because they have done a great job coming in and saying, here's where they're, what they're thinking now, and being receptive about what a collective proposal would be going forward based on being realistic and stretching ourselves to try to solve parts of this problem. So we are working on that. And I want to close this comment on this section by saying we cannot overstate how great the work of CBO has been on this performance report. I think it's an underutilized tool, and we have been promoting it in terms of people actually reading it within the bureaus and actually engaging with the data. And to speak more about that point about what data we should actually be collecting, it has really started a good and strong and more serious effort about, we collect a lot of data, to Commissioner Fisher's point, what is the most important stuff we should be collecting that we can have an impact upon? So thank you for doing that, and we will continue to work around all these questions around what the future of the housing emergency entails and what we can actually make progress on.
Thank you. CAO Reinhart. So just to close out this recommendation slide, and I also do want to make clear that, you know, a lot of the things that we're talking about today, a lot of our recommendations are work that is reflecting work that's already underway. We're just trying to elevate sort of the urgency around those needs. But we do recommend that we add an out-year in-field sampling in the summer months, as Shannon discussed, to supplement our current point-in-time count. And then we utilize the opportunity provided by the rental registration system to gather real-time data on the local housing market.
Question, why would we do it in the summer when we do the other one in the winter? That wouldn't necessarily compare apples to apples.
You know, so I think it's arguable either way. I think we don't have any information currently about the houseless population in the summer months. Mm-hmm. So especially if we used a different methodology, so the HUD point-in-time count is more of a census, requires a significant amount of resources to do that. If we have a different methodology, so it wouldn't necessarily be apples to apples, as you say, but we'd at least have an apples to orange every other year. So we'd have a sampling, might as well do it at a different time so we can understand more about the summer population.
So it would compare the summer to the following years?
Yeah. I mean, eventually, you would have a longitudinal view
okay.
on it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, and just one more thing. I mean, I think the sampling methodology, you know, it allows you to gather a little bit more information about inflow and outflow. So, where are folks coming from? And I think we could learn a little bit from that as well.
So finally, another recommendation that we have is to really review and dig into performance at the provider level, and this gets to the effectiveness of our investments. So to the mayor's point earlier, and we will commit to working on that with the joint office and with the Housing Bureau and with the county. So moving along.
Okay.
To our second favorite topic.
That's right. So next section. So we're going to talk a little bit about ensuring public safety and police accountability. we can offer a moment for a stretch if needed, but this is a longer section. So this is a really important section too. Public safety made up approximately 59% of general fund expenditures in FY 2017-18. In spending those resources, we're trying to create better outcomes in terms of our reported crime across the city, but also our emergency response times, which is really an indicator of our service quality in this area. So we're going to look at those indicators. We'll look at call volume, and then we'll also look at what we're doing around police accountability, staffing, and use of overtime. So to get started. Touching on crime rates, so reported property and person crime rates, we really only have 3 years of data because of a recent change in how we record these types of data. But these are, you know, obviously an important indicator of the effectiveness of our system. And generally speaking, they have been going up over the last 2 years. So that is pretty evident when you look at the crimes against property on the top and then the crimes against persons in the second layer there. Crimes against society are typically more of a proactive indicator. So, you know, those are crimes like gambling, prostitution that reflect the Bureau's efforts towards solving some of those things. In terms of what we see over the longer term, and this isn't in the graph, but when you look longer term, 10, 20 years, reported crime rates are fairly low in Portland. And that's especially when you look at violent crime rates. And that's over that longer year time horizon. But I do think it's important to note the uptick over the last few years. So what are we doing about that? And that's a big question. So clearly, you know, we have added in this year's budget, the Police Bureau added 49 officers in
Before you move on, can I ask
you
a question
ahead.
Just about the presentation of the data so that I understand it? So
sure.
Fiscal year 15-16, you have 74.32. What is the 74.32?
Sure. So that is 74.32 crimes against